Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll talk a little bit about the history of tranquilizer use in the United States. Now, we are used to now there being a very wide range of psychoactive medications that are available. People know about them. We hear about them all the time. They're now advertised on television. But when the first tranquilizer went on the market in this country, this was in 1955, the drug makers actually worried that there wouldn't be enough demand. The drug that we're talking about is Miltown, and very quickly, this medication became a sensation. So many people asked for it that pharmacies ran out. By 1957, Americans filled 36 million prescriptions for Miltown. This morning, we'll talk a little bit about how this medication changed the perception of anxiety and its treatment. And our guest for the program is Andrea Tone. She is Canada Research Chair in the Social History of Medicine at McGill University in the School of Medicine and Arts. She's the author of a recently published book that's titled The Age of Anxiety, A History of America's Turbulent Affair with Tranquilizers. The book is published by Basic Books. She's also the author of the book Devices and Desires, which was named one of the best books of 2001 by the Washington Post. It inspired an Emmy Award-winning PBS documentary on the birth control pill. Her work has been featured on ABC, PBS, NPR, and the History Channel, and in the New York Times. She makes her home in Montreal, and she's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people keep their questions, comments brief so we can keep things moving along. But, of course, anyone's welcome to call. Professor Tone, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
I probably should begin by issuing a formal apology to all grads of McGill. Yesterday morning, I was talking about the fact that we were going to do this program, and I said that McGill was in Toronto. And immediately somebody was on the phone and said, no, it's not. So to all McGill grads, my apologies for misplacing your alma mater. I will try always to remember from now on.
That's funny.
Well, in any case here, I think nowadays, you know, people, as I said, people are used to the fact that there are a lot of psychoactive medications available intended to treat a variety of things. And we know about these things because they're discussed and they're advertised on television. And I think now probably Miltown is old enough, it's enough back in the past so that some people would say that they'd never heard of it. And that's really stunning when you think about just how many people at one time, particularly in the first maybe about 5 years after it was released, just how many people had taken this. I think one of the statistics that you cite here in the book is that by 1956, so this was just the next year, one out of every 20 Americans had tried Miltown.
Right. I mean, that is one of the remarkable things about the story. As you said in the introduction, when the company first had their hands on what would become the best-selling drug, not just in psychiatric history, but in all of medical history for the 1950s, they were concerned that there couldn't be a market for anti-anxiety drugs because in the early 1950s, the dominant academic model favored talk therapy over pharmacotherapy. Today, as you say, we're used to thinking of these drugs as part of our sort of collective toolkit for staying calm. But in the early 1950s, the company shelved the drug that would become the best-selling drug in American history for fear that doctors would be reluctant to prescribe it or patients wouldn't want to take it. And what happened instead is that after the drug came on the market, within a period of months, the commercial and medical and cultural enthusiasm surrounding it was so extreme that people were forced to wait for hours to get their script filled because, as you say, drugstore inventory actually ran out. The demand exceeded the supply.
Here, and at one point, you have some sales figures that talks about just how quickly things took off, that in the first, about the first month, they sold, the company was manufacturing it, sold something like $7,500 worth. Mm-hmm. And then, though, by August, 85,000. By September, 218,000. And then by Christmas, total sales for 1955 exceeded $2 million. And as you write here in the book, that the manufacturer began the next year with a surprising and welcome challenge, how to fill $1 million worth of back orders for the drug.
Right. It's what every pharmaceutical outfit wants, of course. And they just hadn't expected that kind of a demand. And one of the larger points of the book is that I think we're used to, in an age of cynicism toward pharmaceutical drugs, of thinking about how these drugs are launched in today's day and age as sort of part of a crafty plan to hoodwink consumers or capture another part of the existing psychiatric market. And what's so interesting about the 1950s stories is that it reminds us of sort of the power of surprise, contingency, chance. As the company president Henry Hoyt said, by January, February of 1956, you know, what's amazing about Milltown is that when you're dealing with the public, you're dealing with a great unknown. And I think part of the interesting story of Milltown is just to be able to excavate and chronicle that kind of grassroots frenzy for a drug that was really something quite different for America.
Yeah. Well, before that, I want to step back just a little bit. One of the things that you've talked about here is the fact that at the time that the drug was introduced within the field of psychiatry, there was some question about anxiety, what it was, what was the best way to treat it, and certainly there was not this widespread idea that you could give somebody a pill and that could go some way to treating the problem. And for that reason, as you explained, that the manufacturers, they weren't really even sure, they weren't sure if anybody would prescribe it even if they put the drug out. So what for people who were suffering from what we would call anxiety before Milltown, what was there? What sort of treatment avenues were there?
Well, I mean, here's where it's interesting to look at the longstanding divide in history between medical treatments for something and what people decide to do on their own to treat something. And the dominant medical model in the 1950s for what at the time would be classified as neurosis or someone with a neurotic condition might be to give them talk therapy. If someone was really suffering from symptoms of anxiety, restlessness, insomnia, a doctor might prescribe a barbiturate. So a lot of people were taking barbiturates that they got from their doctors or in many cases that they got directly from pharmacists. And, of course, people throughout all time have taken other things, cigarettes, alcohol, to sort of deal with their frayed nerves. What's important about the Milltown moment is that you have, for the first time, a doctor-sanctioned pill for everyday anxiety. And the reason it becomes so successful, in part, is because it's not linked to prescribing psychiatrists per se. We think of this as a psychiatric drug, and in fact, Milltown was the first modern psychiatric panacea. But in most people's minds in the 1950s, anxiety wasn't a biochemical disorder of the brain, which is how a lot of people classify it today. It was almost a kind of badge of cultural achievement. Anxiety was a lot like neurasthenia in the 19th century. It was something that was the price of success. It was something you could almost be proud of. And because of that casting of anxiety, which again is really different from the way we think of anxiety today, it wasn't such a big deal for ordinary people who thought they were a little uptight to go and see their regular family physicians to get a prescription for this pill. So they weren't seeing psychiatrists. They weren't thinking, oh my gosh, I have a biochemical disorder. I need to take a serious psychiatric pill to deal with it. They're thinking of Milltown and they're talking about it as emotional aspirin, you know, a term that really, I think, underscores the perceived banality and routineness of this pill.
Well, and that goes some way also to explaining how and why it is that the drug became so popular and so many people were taking it. They weren't going to psychiatrists to get it. As you say, they were going to their family doctors. Many physicians would write prescriptions and apparently without much hesitance. So it was apparently very easy to get a prescription for this. And I guess as it became very popular and much in demand, you could get it even if you didn't have a prescription.
Right, and so there was a lot of concern about the bootleg market, but people in the 1950s wrote often about parties, especially in Hollywood or in New York City, where it would be absolutely normal to walk into a lovely house and have Milltown passed around as an appetizer.
That's just, it's sort of hard to believe, although maybe not. I was really tickled, and I read aloud a passage out of the book last night to my wife as I was going through this material where you were talking about the things like the Milteeny, that they were actually drinks that were put together that, like a Milteeny, I guess, is a martini that had a Milltown in it instead of an olive.
Right.
And stuff like that. Or somebody, I think it was Cartier, was making a charm bracelet that had a little charm that was shaped like a pill, and inside it there was room for two Milltown. That it became a fad.
I think that's exactly right. What's also interesting about this drug is the kind of cultural cachet and fashionability of it. And although it becomes popular throughout the United States very quickly, to the point where by 1957, one in three of all prescriptions being written by family physicians are being written for Milltown. So doctors are definitely on board. Patients are stampeding for it. Pharmacists are trying to keep it in stock. But where it first has that kind of mania is in L.A. And Hollywood just kind of grabs this pill, and it's already a culture that is familiar with pills, and it sort of turns this drug into a very affordable, very visible fashion statement. It is a fad. It's something that movie stars and TV personalities are gushing about. Gossip reporters are writing, you know, copious treaties on it. And as I mentioned, you know, at various celebrity galas, Milltown sort of being passed around very casually. But it becomes, because of that, like the latest lipstick or the latest restaurant opening. It's something hip, fun, new, exciting that you can try as a middle-class American. And then you're not really that different from Tennessee Williams, who's talking openly about taking it, Lucille Ball, Norman Mailer. It has this cult following, but it turns a drug into something that looks glamorous and at the same time necessary, because so many TV performers are, you know, swearing by it.
Yeah, and that also helps to explain its popularity here in an age long before there was direct advertising of prescription medications to consumers. It was something that was taken up by the popular culture, and that people were talking about it, and it was everywhere. So people knew what it was, had some idea how widespread it was, had some idea about who was using it. So it was something celebrities were using. They knew that they could just go to their doctor and get it. And that I'm sure that for that reason, a lot of people said, well, this seems like a good thing. At least they were willing to give it a try.
Right. And I think your point about celebrities talking about this openly on television is an important one. And the best example of this is the story of Milton Berle, who was, as many listeners no doubt know, the Mr. Television of the 1950s. You know, a lot of Americans by the late 1950s owned television sets. It was a real turning point in our communications history. And what's phenomenal is just how many millions are watching Milton Berle every Tuesday night religiously, to the point where, you know, various churches and restaurants had to close down on Tuesday night because they just couldn't get enough people there. Everyone was watching Milton Berle. And he was using this drug regularly, and he was talking about it on live television. And you're right, it's illegal in this time period to have direct-to-consumer advertising. And he talks about it so openly, joking about how you don't need to be worried about addiction as long as you're not taking more than your doctor. And I take it so often, I'm thinking of changing my name to Milltown Berle instead of just Milton Berle. And the FDA sort of gets worried that maybe all of these celebrities, and it's not just Milton Berle, it's also Bob Hope, Red Skelton, they're talking about it on their shows, they're talking about it at Emmy and Academy Award shows. So they launch a covert investigation that probably cost tens of thousands of dollars to see if they could find out whether the company was supplying these movie stars with copy to say this on their various shows. And much to the surprise and chagrin of FDA investigators, they determined after a fairly lengthy investigation that there was no hint of impropriety, that celebrities were simply smitten with this drug.
They were true believers.
They were true believers. And this was a time when people weren't as aware of possible side effects pertaining to these drugs. So it seemed like they only had ups to them, and there were no drawbacks.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Andrea Tone. She's a professor of history at McGill University in Montreal, Canada, and is interested in the social history of medicine. We're talking about some of what you will find in her recent book, The Age of Anxiety. The subtitle is A History of America's Turbulent Affair with Tranquilizers, published by Basic Books, and looks at this period that we're talking about here. This would have been in the mid to late 1950s when the first tranquilizer, Miltown, was introduced, and it very quickly became very popular, and a lot of people took it. It has since been kind of eclipsed by another class of drugs, the benzodiazepines, and those are drugs like Librium and Valium. But for one, for a period of time, it was one of the most widely prescribed and used drugs in the United States. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Another interesting part of the story is how it is that Miltown was developed, and it in fact was discovered, or its effect was actually discovered by accident.
Yes, as is true with the invention of so many drugs, I think we are comforted by the idea that men in white lab suits are diligently making all of these drugs that we desperately need by rational design. But the history of pharmacology is seeped with stories of contingency and accident, and Miltown is no exception. The person who ended up getting the patent for Miltown, Frank Berger, was a refugee scientist from Czechoslovakia. He sort of fled at the last minute Hitler's Europe with his new wife, and he ended up getting a job at a public lab in the UK where he, along with hundreds if not thousands of other research scientists in Europe and in the United States, were trying to identify a preservative for penicillin, which before sort of modern technology was adopted, was very, very difficult to create mass quantities of. And this was a time of war. People needed it for soldiers, but it also clearly had a civilian application. So Berger was working on looking for the perfect penicillin preservative, and he stumbled across a compound that didn't work so well to preserve penicillin, but did have really remarkable tranquilizing properties. So he published an article, the first time in a medical journal, that talked about how a drug could be used as a tranquilizer per se. And then once he moved to the United States and was hired by Carter Wallace, he tinkered with that chemical further and created what would become Miltown. So it was all because of the race to try to give people enough antibiotics that tranquilizers sort of came about as a footnote to that larger story.
Mm. Well, what sort of we talked about the fact that that the manufacturer wasn't really sure if there would be any point in bringing this drug to the market because they weren't sure if anybody would be interested or any doctors would prescribe it. What sort of conversation happened within the company? How did they come to make the decision that, yes, they would manufacture the product and they would put it out?
Well, there was a lot of secrecy and tension there because the president of the company, Henry Hoyt, thought that there wouldn't be a market for it. So he created an internal poll, and they surveyed 200 doctors to see if these doctors would be willing to prescribe a drug for run-of-the-mill anxiety. And overwhelming, I think in a telling indictment of the limits of survey research, most doctors said absolutely not. They would not do this. They would, you know, send their patients to a therapist and engage in psychoanalysis to get to the root of it. But, you know, no just band-aiding over the symptoms of anxiety. But Berger, who had invented this, was not deterred, and he independently got someone in the company to create. It's also like a beautiful reflection of the cinematic temperament of 1950s America. They create a movie, a documentary of Reese's monkeys, who are not known for their passivity in captivity. And it showed these monkeys in three different chemical states, so naturally vicious, totally passed out on barbiturates, which, remember, were the drugs that were probably most widely prescribed for anxiety states prior to the advent of Miltown, and then awake but subdued on Milltown. And this was a really important distinction for medical practitioners at this time, because the fear with barbiturates is that they had a well-deserved fear. They have a very low toxicity threshold. So what might be an appropriate amount for you could actually kill me. And mixed with alcohol, which, and a lot of mixing with alcohol was done, they were a public health menace because so many people got sick or died from taking them. So the fact that there was a movie that showed that these monkeys were not passing out on a drug that was making them calm had an incredible impact. And it was shown discreetly at a 1955 scientific meeting out in San Francisco. And it was only when a rival pharmaceutical firm, Wyeth, went to Henry Hoyt, the president of Carter Wallace, and said, "This is such a great drug. If you're not willing to take it to market, can we license for the privilege to take the same drug to market under a different name?" It was only when Hoyt had this offer from a different company that he finally said, okay, maybe it's worth taking the risk. So they brought Milltown to market, Carter Wallace, and then Wyeth brought the same drug under a different trade name called Equinil to market at the same time. But it took a lot of pushing and persuading to get this company to even launch the drug. It's fascinating. A 5-year wait with a lot of barbed arguments and movie making and side deals, and it's a fun story.
Well, I started out saying that I think there might be some people who would say they'd never heard of it. I at least know that I had heard of it. So maybe you have to be of a certain age to know, to at least recognize that it was a drug and that at one time people used it. Why, and although I have to say I've never heard of Equinil, did many people take that version of the drug, and was there some particular reason that they're both the same, essentially they're the same, why one of them became the one that everybody wanted?
Well, Milltown was the one everyone talked about, but I think you're absolutely right to make that distinction. Because Wyeth, which was a more reputable pharmaceutical house, backed Equinil, and because it, unlike Carter Wallace, had a huge army of what at the time were called detail men, who would leave samples at doctors' offices or really try to hit up doctors to prescribe this particular drug, offering them various incentives. Equinil actually, as a brand, captured the majority of the tranquilizer market, even though people on the streets and on television shows, on radio, talked about the drug just as Milltown. It's sort of Milltown became a surrogate name for both of these drugs. But doctors were more likely to prescribe not Milltown but Equinil because of the association between this very lofty, august pharmaceutical firm and this new drug. It's the exact same drug, but the fact that Carter Wallace's great claim to fame prior to Milltown was an over-the-counter laxative put it at a commercial disadvantage, because doctors were saying, you know, what do we really know about this, you know, upstart firm? We know that they have put out this laxative that, you know, claims that you're going to be re-energized by waking up your liver bile, and now they've got this tranquilizer. No thanks. We'll stick with Wyeth.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with a caller here. We have someone in Champaign calling in, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
By any chance, I don't wish to sound flippant, but I'm just curious to know, are the pills, either one of them, colored yellow? Thinking of the Rolling Stones song, Mother's Little Helper, you know, she's always running to get her little yellow pill. Is there any association there at all? Thank you.
Thank you. It's a good question. The little yellow pill that's sung about in Mother's Little Helper actually refers to the drug Valium. And one of the reasons that Keith Richards now I'm just blanking on the lead singer to the Rolling Stones.
Mick Jagger. How could you possibly forget?
Mick Jagger wrote that song is to sort of remind people that it's not just celebrities, but ordinary suburban folk who have nervous breakdowns too. But it's a really sad song that tells us about the somber side effects of taking these drugs. Because if you listen to the lyrics and you follow them through to the end, you realize that the mother's a little helper is the way this woman exits her busy dying day. So she's not a happy suburbanite. She's popping these little yellow pills, these mother's little helpers, and at the end of the day, she decides it's just not worth living life.
Yeah. The Milltown was considered to be a minor tranquilizer as opposed to major tranquilizers, and those would be things like Thorazine, which could, I think, pretty much knock a person right out. So this was something that you could actually take and continue to have a life, although there it was a sedative, and so it could have a sedative effect. And I'm sure, like a lot of medications, it would have the same medicine has different effects on different people. What exactly did Milltown do? And if you took this drug, what did they report in terms of how they felt and what they thought it did for them?
Yeah, what's interesting is that most of the tranquilizer testimonials surrounding Milltown in the 1950s were really positive. So if you're to read the press, if you're to read what doctors are saying about this drug, people presented it as a very safe drug that would eliminate the symptoms of anxiety, although not the root cause of anxiety. So if you had insomnia, if you got agitated before business meetings, if you had an upset stomach because you had to go on board a plane, then Milltown was presented as, you know, something you could take very casually as needed. You could still function. You're not going to fall asleep. It's best to avoid alcohol, although, as you pointed out, in a lot of restaurants, especially in L.A., they had these really fancy cocktails in which the drug was the defining ingredient of the alcoholic beverage. But the idea was that this was a drug that you could take for pretty much anything, and it was safe, so why not?
It was, I think that it is true that before it was put on the market for a general use, there were some tests done. It was given to people who were institutionalized for mental illness and was found in some of those people to be of some benefit. Was this something that that then, though, once it became widely available, was used within, say, within the psychiatric population?
Yeah, it's a good question. The more serious benzodiazepines that were developed in the 1960s were marketed, first of all, much more aggressively than Milltown, but they were also marketed to catch that group of patients who could be either outpatient psychiatric patients or inpatient psychiatric patients. In other words, by the time Librium comes onto the market in 1960 and Valium in 1963, anxiety is already being recast as a more serious psychiatric disorder than it was in the 1950s when people are just sort of going on TV saying, yeah, I feel a little anxious, I popped in Milltown, isn't that great? There were bigger randomized controlled trials done on benzodiazepines with lots of different populations. And what they showed is whether we're talking about aggressive prisoners, you know, housewives who are frigid, this is a drug that's going to help all of those people. So the drug was marketed as something that would help the worried well, the outpatient neurotics, and also a growing number of institutionalized patients who had this serious problem called anxiety.
It is certainly, as within any with any medication, there is possibility of hazardous side effects, and overdose is possible. I think it, depending on who you are, it's possible that one could take a fatal dose of Milltown. Were there problems, and given you think there might be, given the fact that there were a lot of people who were taking this medication, were there problems with side effects?
Yes, and this is the sad chapter to this book. It occupies several chapters in my book. But one of the things that you see in the evidence, the archival fingerprints that are left behind, is just how many people in the 1950s and early 1960s who were taking Milltown felt that they were developing problems, but they didn't have sufficient information to help them figure out what these problems amounted to. And so they would write the AMA, or they would write most often the FDA, asking, you know, the government regulatory agency for advice on their particular problems. So the problems that we are talking about is sometimes people would find it very difficult to get off these drugs, or if you stop cold turkey, you would have a withdrawal reaction. Or there could be problems with excessive sedation, or clearly we realize that this is a drug that should not have been mixed with alcohol, that it could in fact kill you in some cases if you took too much of the drug and alcohol. So people write in, but they just don't feel that they have the same kind of information that we're privileged enough to have today in the age of the internet, where you can just sort of Google side effects for drugs. This is a time when people had to rely on their doctors. You didn't have patient inserts that were available to consumers to say, this is what you should watch for, this is what you need to be worried about. So they had to rely on their doctors for that information, and doctors, in turn, were dependent on manufacturers to get all the latest safety studies. So by the time patients are being considered at the bottom of the totem pole, we can assume that a lot of the scientific information has been filtered, and they're not getting access to, you know, the full, complete story about how these drugs work and who's affected. So there is a long interlude in the history of tranquilizers where we see patients becoming worried or increasingly dependent, becoming developing a tolerance to the drugs, so they need higher and higher doses, or unfortunately going through the excruciating effects of a sudden cessation, which is just not what doctors today would tell someone who's been taking tranquilizers for a long time to do.
The after, I think, about 5 years, that's when the class of drugs, the benzodiazepines, come along, and you have Valium and Librium, and, of course, they're also widely taken and widely prescribed. I think it's true that Equinil and Miltown are still manufactured. Was it just that a new thing came along, and the way we often are with medicines, everybody wants to use the new thing? Or were those drugs, in fact, better? And are there still people who are taking Miltown?
It is still on the market. There are people who are still taking it. I've interviewed some psychiatrists who say they would have preferred to switch their patients from Miltown or Equinil to a benzodiazepine, but patients feel that they're really they've benefited from this drug. They don't want to try a new one, so psychiatrists will keep them on it just for that sake, to keep sort of pharmaceutical continuity alive and well in the patient's bloodstream and consciousness. But to your point about, you know, is it just the newest thing, Librium, is that why it beat out Miltown, or is it actually better? It's a good one. It was both in some ways. By the late 1950s, there were reports that were being published in mainstream medical journals and also specialized pharmacology and psychiatric journals showing that Miltown had some problems, that people were developing dependence, that it was dangerous, that it had caused various problems when it was withdrawn abruptly. And so benzodiazepines, which are chemically very, very different from Miltown, although both are considered anxiolytics or tranquilizers, arrive at a time when there's already a kind of chorus of criticism about the side effects of Miltown, and they seem to be much more potent than Miltown, but also much safer, too, in that you can, for the most part, take almost as many benzodiazepines as you can, and as long as you're not taking alcohol or a different drug, you're probably not going to die from that. It's hard to OD on benzos alone, although it's certainly not difficult to OD on benzos combined with other drugs. But the fact that it seemed like it was safer than Miltown gave it an edge. And also the company pumped millions and millions of dollars, this is Hoffman LaRoche, into advertising this drug as safer, more potent, and yes, a hot new chemical that we should be excited about, you know, another wonderful offering from American pharmaceutical science at a time when, again, the cynicism toward new medications, even psychiatric medications, was very different from the cynicism we have today. There just wasn't the same degree of it back in the 50s and 60s. Mm.
Well, I'm sure that other pharmaceutical companies, once they looked at sales for Miltown and Equinil, had saw exactly how these drugs took off. Did everyone then in the drug business decide, well, we better be going out and looking for our own versions of these things, or maybe we can come along and find something that we could say, this is new and this is better, and that we could get into that market?
No, absolutely. I mean, the success of Miltown just sort of knocked the pants off of Wall Street, and it caught a lot of pharmaceutical firms off guard. A lot of people, not just the executives at Carter Wallace, had believed falsely that there would be no market for psychiatric medication for outpatient complaints, and Miltown had proved them very, very wrong. So you've got this blockbuster drug, and what happens often in the history of American pharmaceutical development is if one company is making millions or billions from a drug, other companies want a piece of that pie. So by the late 1950s, almost every pharmaceutical outfit in the United States and in Europe is racing to try and create in a laboratory environment a drug that will outperform Milltown. And Librium was the answer. It also happened by accident. It was the result of a powder that had been left on a shelf and that was discovered a year and a half after it was first put up there during a spring cleanup. And it was the one last drug that Leo Sternbach, the inventor of Librium and Valium, hadn't sent up to be tested for tranquilizer properties. So the company at that time was just so frustrated with his progress, they had reassigned him from the tranquilizer project back to antibiotic work. But they tested this drug, and lo and behold, it had magical tranquilizing properties. So they very quickly put it out to market, got a lot of commercial hype surrounding it, and it became the new blockbuster of the 1960s.
To, again, introduce our guest for this hour, Focus 580, we're talking with Andrea Tone. She is Canada Research Chair in the Social History of Medicine at McGill University in the School of Medicine and Arts. She's the author of the book, The Age of Anxiety, A History of America's Turbulent Affair with Tranquilizers. The book is published by Basic Books, just come out recently. She's also the author of the book, Devices and Desires, named one of the best books of 2001 by the Washington Post. It inspired the Emmy Award-winning PBS documentary about the birth control pill. Her work has also been featured on ABC, PBS, NPR, and the History Channel. And if you're interested in the book, you can head out to the bookstore and look for it. And questions are also welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, here, a big part of the story here that you're interested in telling, and I want to make sure that we get in and talk about it, is what the development, what are the cummies of these medicines, medicines like Milltown and then later Valium and on, what that meant for the practice of psychiatry, the way that we thought about mental illness, and what was the best way to treat it?
All big questions. One of the things that the successful arrival of pharmacotherapy does for psychiatry in the long haul is that, ironically, it changes the focus on the provision of frontline psychiatric care from psychiatrists to everyday physicians. So we've talked about this a little bit. What happens with Milltown is not that psychiatrists are the ones prescribing it. Psychiatrists remain very stigmatized in the 50s and 60s. Patients start talking to their everyday doctors about what gets classified as everyday complaints. So that in the 1950s includes anxiety. Over time, as we've seen, it also includes a broadening category of what gets considered to be psychiatric illnesses, including depression and bipolar and a lot of the things that we're seeing advertised today as problems that many millions of Americans have and should talk to their doctors about. So the phenomenal success of pharmacotherapy, for one thing, changes who's providing drugs for psychiatric care, and it kind of creates some tension between psychiatrists who feel that they're more qualified to deal with pharmacotherapy issues and the individual nature of psychiatric illness, and family practitioners who would say, but we're the front line, we're the ones who are seeing patients talking about these things, and the patients themselves don't necessarily want to be referred to psychiatrists for treatment. But I think the other really important legacy of Milltown as a drug is it sort of sets up a foundation for accepting as just part of our cultural and pharmaceutical landscape the idea that it's okay to take a pill for everyday ills. And that becomes something that becomes so routinized, so ingrained in the medical fabric of society that by the time Prozac comes out in the 1980s or Ritalin gets marketed for ADD, there's no longer this kind of stigma hanging over these drugs as something that one shouldn't take. It's again, presented because of Milltown as kind of a normal thing that Americans would want to do to make getting through life that much easier. Mm. So anxiety becomes, over time, increasingly codified as a biochemical disorder, as do many of these psychiatric disorders, which in turn makes the validity of pharmacotherapy that much more plausible to Americans and doctors alike.
as this story was kind of this proverbial snowball was starting to roll down the hill, were there people within the medical community, and I'm not thinking just particularly about psychiatrists, but physicians generally who saw the way this was going, who saw just how dramatic the acceptance and the demand was for these kind of medications, and the increasing tendency of maybe people to say, I have this problem, I just want to go to my doctor and say, look, doc, I got this problem, give me a pill and I'm out of here.
Mm-hmm.
Were there people who said, I'm not sure that we're moving in a healthy direction here, even back at that time?
Yes, absolutely. And one of the points of the book is to emphasize that neither doctors nor patients are a monolithic group, and doctors were divided. Psychiatrists were even divided about whether tranquilizers for everyday anxiety was a good thing or not. But there were a lot of people, medically minded and politically minded, who did worry about what it would mean to society to have such a huge portion sort of drugged in this very sedating way. And over time, that concern became a sort of political concern, so that it wasn't uncommon in the 1970s to have psychiatrists calling tranquilizers the opiate of the masses and worrying about whether the tranquilization of America had created an emotionally and politically impotent society. But even in the 1950s, psychiatrists and other doctors were saying, what does it mean to tranquilize away this tension, this sort of knotty feeling in your stomach? What will that do to an individual's development? Perhaps we need anxiety to learn just to survive life. It's sort of a necessary prequel to old age survival. There are others who are saying anxiety is a seedbed of genius. If you tranquilize it away, you're not going to have all of this incredible outpouring of creative scientific talent, and that would be a terrible loss for society as a whole. Would we have Einstein if Einstein had been taking Miltown and Valium? Well, yes, but we might not have had his wonderful contributions to math and science. So there was a lot of discussion about the safety of these drugs, but also broader philosophical debates about really what does it mean to have so many people taking drugs just to get through the day? What does that say about our society, and what will the political and even artistic consequences be?
Yeah. Today, when people think about and talk about drug abuse, I'm sure the very first thing that they think of are illegal drugs. But it's also the case that we have a significant issue in this country with what I think in the academic field is called non-medical use of prescription drugs. These are things that are legally available that doctors write prescriptions for, but that people may be using in some variety of ways. Either they're prescribing for themselves, they may indeed be getting it from their doctor. We have a problem with an issue with people being able to get drugs over the internet. We have people passing medicines back and forth. They're saying, here, I tried this. It's really been really good for me. Here, have some of this. And that can certainly be a problem, particularly when people are mixing things together and you're getting drug interactions. And I think that one of the issues here is that people think, well, this is a prescription medication. It's legal. It's safe. I have a prescription for this, so I'm not going to have a problem. And it seems that the same thing, maybe to a somewhat lesser scale, happened back at this time when people maybe ended up having trouble with these medications and were surprised because they said, "What? But my doctor gave this to me. It's approved. It's a legal thing. I never would have thought that I would have had a problem with this."
Right. And I think it's important to remember that this is pre the consumer rights movement, pre-women's health movement. So the very fact that it's doctor prescribed gave it this kind of halo of safety and authenticity. And so people would say, well, I got it from my doctor. It must be okay for you too. And there was a lot of drug sharing then, just as there remains a lot of sharing of prescription drugs today. But over time, the problem, of course, with all of these drugs is that people are biochemically unique. How you interact with a specific drug is going to vary person by person. And these drugs, if a person is going to use them, really do need to be carefully monitored with a professional who's capable of, assessing the pros and cons and whether this is the right dose, whether it works with, the vitamin supplements you take. And drug sharing sort of by passes that sort of custodial arrangement, and it becomes very dangerous when that happens, absolutely.
Do you think that the popularity of these kinds of medications helped to, in some way, set the ground for the recreational kind of drug use that we saw maybe, you know, 5-10 years later?
I don't think you can blame prescription tranquilizers per se. I think throughout American history we've seen sort of recreational use of a range of different medications. What maybe set these drugs aside was the fact that they were being so widely used in, as it turned out, sort of unexpected places. That when we think about drug problems historically, we usually imagine them to be problems that erupt in marginalized communities, hippies, radical vets, the unemployed, immigrants have often been associated with different drug menaces. So the discovery in the late 1960s that the number one user of these proper prescription-only tranks were suburban housewives sort of really upended all of these fixed ideas about what abuse of drugs means. And people feared that these drugs had really kind of invaded or sort of chemically hijacked suburbia and all of the wonderful apple pie trappings that came with it. And I think that feminization of drug use created a whole different stigma surrounding prescription drugs. And I don't think it caused the recreational use. I think it collapsed the boundaries, finally, between acknowledging that prescription drugs can be used recreationally, can be abused, just like any other kind of drug, that there doesn't need to be that sort of hardcore distinction between, oh, I got these from my doctor, they're safe, versus, oh, I got these from a bootlegger on the street, they're bad drugs. Mm.
We have about 5 minutes left. I have a couple of callers, so we'll try to get them in. And first one is in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes, hello. Mm-hmm. I wanted to compliment your guest on her knowledge in this area. It's extreme, and it's wonderful to find someone like that. As a user of some of these medications, it's interesting. My family has a history of suicide, and everything goes back 40 or 50 years, and it took me probably about 15 years to educate even psychiatrists that I needed some of these things.
Hmm.
You know, I was able to function fairly well in society.
Well, and I appreciate the comments of the caller. I mean, I guess in having the conversation we're having, I don't think that I or the guest would mean to suggest that these drugs are all bad, and that there aren't people who could certainly benefit from using them. I would not say that, and I'm sure that she would not say
no,
that.
No, absolutely. In fact, you know, I tried in writing this book to dodge the kind of politically charged questions surrounding this very issue. Are these drugs good or are they not good? I think they're really good for certain people, and they have been less good for others. But the history that I've told, which I hope is that people will find a people-packed history, is as much about the success stories as the people who had horrible side effects and who viewed this drug in the end as something they wish they hadn't taken. But clearly that assessment about whether people should be taking these drugs or not needs to be on a case-by-case basis. And your caller is absolutely right to point out that sometimes the education goes from the bottom up and patients are put in the unenviable position of having to convince their doctors that this is a drug they are willing to take the risks of having in their system.
Well, thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. To Bloomington, Illinois, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. Good
yes.
morning. Thank you for an excellent program as usual. I remember in the 40s my mother reading a book called Happy Though Neurotic, something like that. It was a very popular book, and but I don't remember her, you know, she didn't take any drugs, I don't think, as I know. But I was wondering, do I understand that the composition is of Milltown was a preservative, basically, then?
Yes, it's a derivative of a penicillin preservative. The drug that preceded it was mefenesin, and mefenesin was the preservative that's then reworked in a laboratory in New Jersey to create the compound that becomes Milltown.
Mm-hmm. So it's still available to people who began very early on taking it?
It is, and it's also prescribed as a muscle relaxant.
Oh, it has another name.
As Milltown or Equinil still.
Oh, well, that's interesting. And some of your comments reminded me that I believe even on this program I heard at one point that way back, Coca-Cola and 7-Up contained lithium and cocaine, and that housewives were the consumers of that.
Yes, some really interesting work has been done on early drug addiction, and we sort of, again, think of addiction as something that's not likely to happen to proper middle-class households, and yet history time and time again proves us wrong, and a lot of those early beverages contain very, very addictive substances, including opiates.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, we're coming to the point where we have to finish here. And again, I don't mean to belabor the point about are these medicines good or bad. I guess what we can say, because now we have a very long list of psychoactive medications that are specifically prescribed for anxiety, and then other medications that do other sorts of things. And as we talked, they're the kind of things that now we hear about more and more because there is direct advertising to consumers now, something that certainly was not the case in 1955. It seems that we're unlikely to go back, that these kinds of medications are going to continue to be heavily promoted and probably fairly widely used, perhaps mostly for good, but one doesn't know.
That's right, and I think you're right that there's no reason to doubt that the anxiolytic market will simply vanish. Historically, it's done best, unfortunately, during times of economic and social crisis, and it's sold best in January and December, which for many people are just the worst months of the year, all the holiday hyperbole to the contrary. But I think that the take-home point is that these drugs are potent chemicals, but they're also social compounds and how we evaluate their value and their worth to society and to an individual really has changed a lot. And we need to sort of appreciate those evaluations in specific contexts. And that includes today's context. And it's unfortunately to every individual to sort of work out for themselves in consultation, one hopes, with a very well-educated doctor, whether this is a drug that's good for them, and if so, how long they should be taking it. But it needs to be done on a case-by-case basis, I think, without resorting to generalizations that just say, oh, we're over-medicated or we're under-medicated. For some people are probably under-medicated. Other groups clearly are over-medicated. But we need to break it down, disaggregate it, and sort of think of this on a person-by-person case.
Our guest, Andrea Tone, professor of history at McGill University. She is the author of the book The Age of Anxiety, A History of America's Turbulent Affair with Tranquilizers, published by Basic Books. And Professor Tone, thank you very much.
Thank you.